Okay, so buckle up, everybody. We're going to talk about 1,000 different things today. It is an absolutely packed show. Huge breaking news in the Democratic primary, as I'm sure you already know. But we've also got other stories that I think, unfortunately, have been sort of swallowed up by how much news has been generated over the past 24 hours. So I want to look at a couple of the things that happened yesterday in Congress that are incredibly important. Some good news, some bad news, both very important to make sure that we get to. Also, later on the show, we've got a director of The End of Meat, Mark Pearshall, is going to be coming on to talk about what the world and our health might look like if humanity were to give up consuming meat entirely. So big documentary now available. We're going to break it down. Later on, we're going to close out the show with a couple of stories about education. So on the one hand, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has provided some awesome context to the conversation we're having right now about advantages and admissions to the best colleges. So that story is a big story in terms of, you know, 50 people plus going down for bribery and corruption and all of that. But there are some more structural issues that she's pointing out that I want to make sure that we acknowledge as well. And then The View weighs in with Meghan McCain defending legacy admissions in a totally not self-serving way. We'll have that for you a little bit later on as well. But we start off with the big news. Beto's in. He announced this morning Beto O'Rourke will be running for president in the Democratic primary. I guess it feels like it was inevitable. It seemed like there was a little bit of second guessing very briefly, but now he's in. And here is how he announced that he's running in this video.
Amy and I are happy to share with you that I'm running to serve you as the next president of the United States of America. This is a defining moment of truth for this country and for every single one of us. The challenges that we face right now, the interconnected crises in our economy, our democracy, and our climate have never been greater. And they will either consume us or they will afford us the greatest opportunity to unleash the genius of the United States of America. In other words, this moment of peril produces perhaps the greatest moment of promise for this country and for everyone inside of it.
Okay, so that goes on for about 2.5 minutes. It's intense. It's oddly intense for a sort of impromptu living room announcement address. But I guess that's the way he is, and that's the way he's begun speaking in public, so I guess it's infected his home life as well. So look, Beto O'Rourke is an interesting figure, and in this video, I'm going to break down some of the benefits, some of what he brings to this race, and some of the, obstacles, I would say, that he's going to face in trying to become the Democratic nominee this time around. There's going to be a lot of hot takes today, and there are going to be people who are already on the Beto train that think, oh, he's definitely going to win this, he definitely should win this. And on the other side, there are some people who are going to attempt to convince you that he is literally the worst thing that has ever happened. Something in the middle, I would say, is more likely to be true. He does have some good qualities, and he does have some significant drawbacks, and we're going to talk about those. Before we get into that, though, like I talked about the video, the way that his rollout has happened is a little bit bizarre, and I think some people have noticed this. So, first of all, Vanity Fair has their big cover story on him. That was sort of how we knew he was running. That came out. Let's take a look at this cover. And you'll see Beto O'Rourke on a dusty trail with a dog sort of oddly crammed in the corner looking at him ashamed, like the dog has like torn up the toilet paper or something. I don't really get that. But the more important part is up above where it says Beto's choice, quote, "I want to be in it, man. I'm just born to be in it." Which is sort of a weird thing to say for someone who served a couple of terms as a congressman from Texas. It is now like very certain that this is his destiny. And as many people have pointed out, I mean, imagine virtually any other candidate announcing in that particular way. Think about if Bernie was like, "I was born to be in this thing." I mean, the people who hate Bernie would hate him 10 times as much after hearing that. Think about any female candidate whatsoever. Imagine if Hillary Clinton had said, "I was born to this race." Like, come on, how much would people attack her? Beto has this sort of weird folksy sleeves rolled up charm, so I guess he gets away with it to some extent. But this isn't just like one random quote that was thrown out there. I want to read from this Vanity Fair article. He talked a little bit about one of his first big public addresses, and the way he talks about it is just a little bit weird. He says, "I don't ever prepare a speech. I don't write out what I'm going to say. I remember driving to that. I was like, what do I say? Maybe I'll just introduce myself. I'll take questions. I got in there, and I don't know if it's a speech or not, but it felt amazing because every word was pulled out of me, like by some greater force, which was just the people there. Everything that I said, I was like watching myself being like, how am I saying this stuff? Where is this coming from? Dude, where is that coming from? What are you talking about? Like, okay, I understand. If you go to do a public address, especially if it's your first big one, I would be horrified. And if I got through it at all, I'd be pretty proud of myself. But I wouldn't say that, like, the creator of the universe is stuffing my mouth full of words to shower the audience with. That's just, people are saying that it's sort of a messiah complex. And it might be that is being overplayed. And it might be that this was just a really weird Vanity Fair article. I don't know. But he needs to avoid that sort of talk. Like, you can't have this sort of, I guess, like, divine right entitlement to the nomination, in particular in what is going to be the most contested Democratic primary in our lives, by far. There are so many people, many of whom have a lot more experience, a lot more legislative accomplishments, a lot more sort of call to run than Beto O'Rourke. And it's not to say that he can't run. He's very popular. A lot of people like him. And his Senate run against Ted Cruz was incredibly hard fought, very close, far more than people would have thought a month out from the race, let alone a year out from the race. He did a great job there. But he's not Kennedy. And he definitely seems to think that he's Kennedy in the way he speaks about himself. And whoever was taking the pictures for this Vanity Fair thing, they were thinking about JFK literally every time they snapped that button. Take a look at some of these photos and you'll know what I'm talking about. So in terms of what he brings, as I've pointed out, and I know that I'm harping on this, but he is very popular. And it's weird to talk constantly about how popular a politician is rather than here are the reasons they're popular. But I honestly believe that for a lot of these people, they don't necessarily know why. I'm part of that to some extent. Like, back during that race, I was pretty excited about him. Like, I remember, you remember the video that went viral of him talking about Colin Kaepernick? It was a great public address. He did a great job. He was captivating in a number of cases, but he wasn't necessarily captivating because of his Elizabeth Warren-esque bold proposals to fix the structural problems in America. That's not really what it was about. And now it might be that in the end he will have that platform. He will have the most robust platform that is up to the task of dealing with all the problems that we have as a country. But I don't see it yet. In fact, I went to his website to see not what does he stand for, you should be able to get that from other sources, but how does he want to frame himself? Because every candidate on their site chooses to focus on one or more issues. He has so far chosen to focus on zero. On his website, there's a shop section, it's first. There's a job section, I think to work for him. And there's a donate section, of course, it's American politics, you need money. There was no platform area, there was nothing. Now, it'll come at some point, but right out the gate, it's very much a look at me, not a here are 10 reasons you might want to support my candidacy. And look, he's going to have no problem getting the donors to get on the debate stage. I have no doubt about that. He'll do quite fine in that area. He'll get the 65,000. He'll be on there. I really do think, though, that people project onto him what they want to see. I think that centrists see him as, again, like Biden, a return to the old normal way of doing things. I think that some progressives project onto him with his rhetoric perhaps a stronger commitment to certain progressive policy priorities than he really has. I mean, I covered all of his debates with Ted Cruz, and I know that he technically supports Medicare for all, but his actual descriptions of what that would mean in practice is not radical by any means. In a little bit, I'm going to get to his positions on the Green New Deal, which sounds great, but we will have to see what it really means when the rubber hits the road. And again, in terms of actual legislative accomplishments, do you remember how much Bernie was attacked, even though he has passed many bills over the years? Beto O'Rourke doesn't even have that. And so I'm not saying that Beto O'Rourke is the devil, and I'm not saying that if he were the candidate, I wouldn't support him. Obviously, I would. You would have to be a madman not to. But the idea that he is going to stroll in here and simply grab his destiny, that is not the case. And I think this race is going to be a lot tougher for him than he seems to think at this point. And his supporters should be ready for possibly a long, hard slog. Anyway, with that, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk just a little bit more about one of his positions on an incredibly important topic, and then we'll move on to other news.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. So much to get to. Let's jump back into it. Beto O'Rourke, in addition to announcing he'd be running for the presidency today, also had a public event, and at it, he was asked about the Green New Deal. And while I might, in the end, have a big issue with how he, as president, hypothetically, would actually go about pursuing a Green New Deal, at the very least, his rhetoric, what he wants you to believe he thinks about it, is pretty damn good. So here's how he responded to a question about that. He said, "Let us all be well aware that life will be a lot tougher for the generations that follow us, no matter what we do. It is only a matter of degrees. Along this current trajectory, there will be people who can no longer live in the cities they call home today. There's food grown in this country that will no longer prosper in these soils. There's going to be massive migration of tens or hundreds of millions of people from places that are going to be uninhabitable or under the sea. This is the final chance. The scientists are unanimous on this. We have no more than 12 years to take incredibly bold action on this crisis." I think that's pretty good. Like, that was not part of his, I mean, for all I know, he's answered this question a bunch of times, I guess, over the past few months and has it down pat. But this wasn't part of his stump speech. This was in response to a question. And that's about as well as I would hope to put it, honestly, in at least communicating to the audience that he truly gets how big this issue is. Not just generalized average warming across the globe, but some of the ways that it will actually affect human life in terms of making farming much more difficult, leading to mass migration, issues like that. And he also cites the 12-year sort of timeline that we have to do something about this coming out of the UN report from last year. So that is important. Now, none of that really has anything to do with the Green New Deal, to be fair, but he does get into it in this next graphic. He says, "Some will criticize the Green New Deal for being too bold or being unmanageable. I tell you what, I haven't seen anything better that addresses the singular crisis we face, a crisis that could, at its worst, lead to extinction. The Green New Deal does that. It ties it to the economy and acknowledges that all of the things are interconnected." And look, he talked about this for a little bit longer, and he does go into understanding why elements of racial justice need to be included in this. He talked about how asthma rates, respiratory illness, things like that caused by pollution are not sort of spread equally across our country and that they affect certain communities more. So he really does seem to, at the very least, understand the rhetoric that underlies a lot of our concerns that would lead to something like the Green New Deal. Now, as always, we need to find out what he actually means when he talks about this, because right now, virtually all of the Democratic candidates say that they support a Green New Deal. I mean, John Delaney is the only one that I have seen actually speak out against it. But they don't all support it in the same way, and the devil is very much in the details. So we're going to have to see. Once he gets on the debate stage and people are talking about specifically what they would do to put this into effect, not in terms of rhetoric, but in terms of where is the money actually going to go? What, I guess, orthodoxies in terms of the construction of our economy are you willing to question in making this a reality? He wants you to believe that he will go hard in that direction, but he needs to prove that that's actually the case. So as of right now, I'm willing to give him a good amount of credit for his advocacy for a Green New Deal, but we still have to see a lot more. And again, I'm just going to return to this. Like, you're going to hear a lot of hot takes about Beto O'Rourke. Here's the thing. Nobody really knows how this primary is going to play out. They certainly don't know how it's going to play out based on who runs and who doesn't run. And Beto O'Rourke, like, he could be the candidate. Like, that's entirely possible. Or he could flame out before the first debate. There's so many people running, and as I do my research every day and choosing what stories I'm going to cover, I see whisperings of candidates I've literally never heard of before that are also talking about running. In the end, we could have 30 people who say that they're running. Now, that's not the same thing as actually being on the debate stage, actually qualifying for a primary or caucus. And I fully believe that before we get to that first debate in June, some of these candidates will not exist anymore. And not all of them are going to be people that you've never heard of. That's just the way it works. They're going to find that they're not able to actually get the small donor support that they want. Their platforms or their experience is too close to other candidates who are taking the support from them. Beto O'Rourke might run into that problem as well, because while he has, you know, some of the charisma and all of that, he doesn't really have the track record that some of these other sort of more centrist, but I want you to consider me a progressive candidates already have. And so I think that that could be a big problem for him. So we'll have to see, and we'll track that over time. Let's move on to another topic. Yesterday, the Senate voted once again to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. Now, if you recall, this actually happened the first time in December. It looked like it was going to be finalized in the Senate, but they didn't want that. In the House, Paul Ryan stopped that. At the time, the Democrats didn't control the House, and so it didn't go any further. So it looked like we were on the cusp of something we have not seen in our lifetime, the Senate actually asserting its deserved authority in matters of military conflict. So we had that in the Senate. But the House stopped it. And then the midterms happened. And so it passed once again, thanks to people like Ro Khanna and others who've been pushing for this for some time. And now, finally, over threats from Donald Trump, you know, explicitly and implicitly, a number of Republican senators actually did sign on to this. And in the end, despite the fact that the Republicans maintained their majority in the Senate, it passed 54 to 46. It will go back to the House of Representatives now. They have to get the language exactly the same as the Senate version, but that is likely to pass again as it has already this cycle. If you haven't been following this, here's what the bill would do. It invokes the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which states that if U.S. troops are involved in hostilities abroad, quote, without a declaration of war or specific statutory authorization, such forces shall be removed by the president if the Congress so directs by concurrent resolution. That's fancy talk for the president is granted huge leeway that he doesn't technically have in law or under the Constitution to send troops wherever he wants. And way back decades and decades ago, the Congress said, okay, this is the way it's been working, but our military is both much larger than it was. The executive branch is much more powerful than it once was. And American presidents have shown that they're willing to unilaterally use military force in a way that they didn't necessarily do in past generations. So back before I was born, the Congress said, no, we're actually going to take control of this process. So they passed the War Powers Act, and then it never was used, not even once, despite the fact that we've been involved in countless military conflicts ever since then. As of yesterday, that has changed, and it's changed as a result of bipartisan support, although the vast majority of it was Democratic, and Bernie Sanders deserves so much credit in the Senate for passing this. He's not the only one. Mike Lee, a Republican, also was important, and Chris Murphy, another Democrat, was incredibly important as well. But look, if you've been listening to the Damage Report for a while, you know how much we've talked about Yemen, how high the stakes are there, how high the death toll already is. We desperately need to not be involved in that conflict. And although Donald Trump could hypothetically either ignore this law, he could veto it, we'll see. Hypothetically, this means that we will finally no longer be involved in that conflict, and that has been a long time coming. We're going to take a short break. We come back, lots more domestic news to get to. And later on, the director of The End of Meat joins us to talk about some of the benefits that might come from stopping meat consumption a little bit later on. Look, I get it more than most that there's a lot that goes on every single day, and we struggle here to cram as much into every possible show, but there are things that are operating generally in the shadows that are incredibly important, not just for what happens day to day while Donald Trump is president, but that will have ramifications long after he's out of office, in the ground, or in jail, wherever he ends up. And one of those has to do with his judges. So you might have seen yesterday that Naomi Rao was confirmed by the Senate to a position on the U.S., the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That is the second highest court in our entire country. They are incredibly important. In some ways, more important than the Supreme Court, at least in the vast majority of areas where cases don't actually make it to the Supreme Court. They stop at the Court of Appeals in a lot of cases. And she is going to be on that, despite very legitimate concerns about her positions like on sexual assault and on abortion rights. So the vote in the end was 53 to 46. You wonder how that broke down? Oh, that was all Republicans supporting her nomination and all Democrats voting against confirming Rao. Now, I understand that we're in an incredibly partisan time. I get that. But it's possible that if you can't get a single Democrat to vote in favor of a judicial nominee, maybe you could find a different judicial nominee, especially considering that she has no experience actually trying cases or anything like that. Seems kind of important. Also important that, like I said, her positions on some of these issues are very suspect. So Elizabeth Warren said after the vote, Mrs. Rao's record shows that she will continue to tilt our courts in favor of the powerful few and leave everyone else behind. And look, I don't want to relitigate her entire record. You can go back through this if you want to. But so she in college wrote a series of editorials. And in one, she talked about sexual assault in a case where a woman is drunk. And here's one of the things she said. Unless someone makes her drinks undetectably strong or force them down her throat, a woman, like a man, decides when and how much to drink. And if she drinks to the point where she can no longer choose, well, getting to that point was part of her choice. So look, now she's a judge. It's possible that that was just her in college. I'm sure I believed some crazy things when I was in college. I don't have the power of a judge. I don't have anything like the power of a judge, and I anticipate that I never will. But now she does. And not just a judge who will hear individual cases, a judge who will set precedent for cases outside of her own personal influence, and who will be there again for the rest of her life if she wants to. I'm looking at the picture. I don't know exactly how old she is. She looks pretty young. I feel like she could last there a long time. So let's dream. Now let's dream that in 2 years, Bernie Sanders becomes president. And Bernie Sanders works hard to pass progressive legislation. And finally forces not only some Republicans to come over, but he corrals the Democrats, including centrists, to support his agenda. They pass a law. And then for the next couple of years, we have to watch every court challenge. Because the Republicans are going to be looking for the court that's most likely to strike down one of his laws. And this court is now one judge closer to striking down everything that Bernie Sanders chooses to do. Now, she says that she doesn't believe what she believed before about abortion and about sexual assault. She says every form of it is abhorrent. Responsibility for rape is with the rapist. That's good. I hope that she sticks with that once she has the power. Understand that she was saying that while she was trying to get the position, which is very different than what they will do once they have the position. We've seen that throughout the Trump presidency. But here's the thing. While Naomi Rao is incredibly important because of how radical she is on these issues, she is just one of tons, dozens and dozens and dozens of judges that Donald Trump has been able to get as president. As of today, that's 91 Article III judges nominated by Trump, including two associate justices of the Supreme Court, 36 judges for the U.S. Courts of Appeals. So imagine 36 Naomis around the country, 53 judges for the United States District Courts, which are also incredibly powerful and incredibly important, not as powerful as the Courts of Appeals, but still very important. That is what he already has. That's locked in. If Donald Trump was marched, he was like frog marched out of the White House today by Robert Mueller, he would still have those 91 judges. And every day that he stays in power, he is likely to increase that number. Right now, there are currently 62 additional nominations, including 6 for the Courts of Appeals, 54 for the District Courts, and 2 for the Court of International Trade, a court that he has thus far not been able to get anyone on. But he's trying. And this is all going on. Again, these sorts of nomination hearings, they don't even get the sort of, like, we have some controversy when he tries to get a new head of the DOJ, or, you know, if he's going to have a new Secretary of Defense, there'll be a lot of debate about that. New head of the CIA, we'll talk about that. But these don't get covered nearly as much, even though they are arguably more important, because each of their decisions generally also won't be covered nearly as much. They will generally exercise their power without much public scrutiny. And again, they will do so for the rest of their lives. And so please bear in mind, in future cases, when you are considering who to support for president, you should always, always, always think about the effect long term for the rest of yours and my life, the effect on the courts. Donald Trump has not been very effective at pursuing his legislative agenda. He's gotten a few things that he wants. The tax cuts that he wanted, those are gigantic. That's true. But he hasn't been able to get everything he wants legislatively. When it comes to judicial nominations, though, he has been incredibly successful. And in many ways, that's even more important. So bear that in mind. Let's turn now to something scary. Donald Trump was interviewed by Breitbart, which he likes to pretend is a legitimate news source. And in it, he talked about a lot of topics. One area he got into was what I view as a fairly explicit threat of political violence. He said this, "You know, the left plays a tougher game. It's very funny. I actually think that the people on the right are tougher, but they don't play it tougher, okay? I can tell you I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough. Until they go to a certain point, and then it would be very bad, very bad. But the left plays it cuter and tougher. Like with all the nonsense that they do in Congress, with all these investigations, that's all they want to do is, you know, they do things that are nasty. Republicans never played this." Individually, most parts of that are pretty terrible and obviously false. Republicans are gigantic on investigations, even if there's literally nothing there to investigate. But look at what he said there. He said that I have the military, I have the police, I have the bikers, I have the people with guns, I have the people with weapons. And generally, they don't play it tough until they go to a certain point, and then it would be very bad, very bad. Do you remember what Michael Cohen was saying during his testimony about the way that Donald Trump instructs people to do what he wants? How he operates like a mob boss. He doesn't say, "I want you to do this." He gives you the idea that this is a thing that would benefit me, and then he puts it out there. No, I don't think that there's a lot of policemen that are looking to gun people down for Donald Trump or members of the military. Maybe the bikers for Trump, I don't know those guys. I know a lot of bikers, not bikers for Trump. But that is him saying that if it comes to it, I have the people with the weapons. Now, this is a sort of quote that, like, I'm going to move on. I'm not going to talk about this tomorrow, but I will at least talk about it now. Most people won't even do that. But how is that anything other than the president threatening Democrats and people on the left with political violence if they do something that he doesn't like? If it gets to that point, a certain point, what's the certain point? Is a certain point the Mueller report? Is a certain point if Don Jr. is indicted? Is a certain point what Michael Cohen was scared of during that testimony, that he loses a legitimate election? What is the certain point that would lead to his supporters feeling like they need to take up arms against their political opponents? Now, he's, of course, vague. He wants plausible deniability. He doesn't want you to be able to say, oh, he obviously told someone to gun another person down there. But that is the entire point of it. And the fact that he linked it explicitly in the next sentence with the Mueller report is not some accident, okay? That is what he is scared of. That's what's on his mind right now. And he's apparently thinking about his supporters, and he's thinking about what they can bring to bear if his presidency is fatally imperiled, something that is possibly coming in the next few weeks. So be on the watch. His supporters are angry. They talk about a civil war constantly. We've covered that. On Fox News, they are fed a diet of civil war talk constantly, the need to take up arms. That is what the NRA TV is about. That is what Alex Jones is talking about. That is the media diet that they have. And Donald Trump, rather than distancing himself from that violent rhetoric, is encouraging it. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We come back. More to get to. Stick around. We're joined now on the Damage Report by Mark Piachel, director of The End of Meat. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to talk to you about your documentary. I have a number of different questions because there's interesting both personal and worldwide implications of the consumption of meat. But before we get into some of the specifics, tell me about the documentary.
Sure. Well, basically, it's about the idea how our world would look like if we stopped eating animals, well, meat and animal products. So we traveled the world. We went to the US, to Canada, to India, all across Europe to look for people who already are working on this idea. We talked to philosophers, to scientists, to activists, artists, entrepreneurs, and there's really, really a lot happening, and it's an exciting idea. So that's what the film's about.
So there are a number of documentaries that focus on the negative impacts of eating meat. I've seen several of them, but you've chosen not to do that. Why is that the case?
Sure. Well, I wanted to turn things around, and I wanted to look at the benefits of plant-based diets, or just if we leave meat out of the equation. So what would happen? How would our world change? And what are the benefits? So that was the idea, because there's enough negative implications that people are focusing on. And instead, I wanted to focus on the positive benefits of this diet.
So if everybody did decide, if today we decided as a species that we're not going to consume meat anymore, in 10 or 50 years, what would the world actually look like?
Well, we talked to a scientist from the Oxford Future of Food program, and he calculated that we would actually save $1.5 trillion in climate damages and healthcare costs, and we would avert 8 million deaths by 2050 each year.
Wow. Okay, that's significant. Well, let's start with the climate change. That's a topic that we cover quite a bit on the Damage Report. And we understand that industrialized agriculture and the consumption of meat, which is a big part of that, produces a lot of emissions. How significant, if we were to cut out all meat consumption, how significant would that be for the overall battle in stopping climate change?
Well, it's responsible for 18% of greenhouse gas emissions, so that's almost more than all transportation combined. And it's pretty easy because it's something that everyone can do. So it's just leaving out meat and animal products from our diets, and there's so many alternatives now that it's just really simple to do this, and it's a small step for everyone, I think.
And I've seen some statistics indicating that veganism is becoming more common in recent years. Is that something that you've seen? Do you expect that that's a trend that's going to continue?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that was the initial idea for the film, because in Germany, around 5 or 6 years ago, this really entered the mainstream. We even now have traditional meat-producing companies that do vegetarian and vegan products, and we have more shops, more restaurants converting to veganism or introducing more vegan dishes. So it's really exciting, and we see this spreading to other countries as well, not just in Europe, but across all across the world.
Yeah, and look, I have to admit that I'm in Los Angeles, so it's perhaps a little bit of a bubble, but I've noticed that even in restaurants that have not traditionally had any sort of appeal or brand identity for vegetarianism or veganism are starting to include like meatless hamburgers and things like that. So it seems like it's becoming a little bit easier for people who are interested in trying out a new diet to sort of dip their toes in it, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have these products, or you have the products like the Beyond Burger or the Impossible Burger that are insanely popular. And the taste is not much different from classic hamburgers or, yeah, classic meat products. So it's becoming more and more easy for these people. And it's in Germany, it's not the vegans or the vegetarians driving the change. It's the flexitarians. So people who are eager to try out these products, but they don't want to become vegan or vegetarian overnight. So, yeah.
So you had the opportunity, as you were traveling around, as you said, you spoke with a lot of different scientists, and I know that there are various efforts to replace like actual agriculture in terms of raising and slaughtering animals with some sorts of lab-based alternatives. What does that technology look like in early 2019?
Well, it's called cultured meat or clean meat, so you probably have heard of that. And it was just approved by the USDA and FDA in the US, so it's not too long before these products will hit the market. And we've talked to a scientist from the Netherlands, Mark Post, who's one of the pioneers, and yeah, he showed us how the process works. So they take cells from an animal and then they multiply them so that they can have burgers or can produce steaks with that.
And do they have any sort of idea of when that might be, like, rise to the scale where it can actually replace a significant percentage of the meat that's traditionally raised around the world?
Well, it's still a process that's a bit hidden because not all of the companies feel or don't want to talk about how it's going to finally look like, because they have investors that they don't want to share these ideas. But it's going to be a process that might look like a brewery, where you can go into a brewery and then you have these big stainless steel tanks where they grow the meat. And the companies we've talked to in the film say maybe 3 to 5 years. So when we interviewed them, so maybe now 2-3 years, possibly, I don't know.
You know, it's interesting. So as you're talking about this lab, and I know I've had conversations with friends about lab-grown meat, and they like, the concept sort of makes some people recoil. It seems sort of weird or perhaps gross, the idea of a vat. And the thing is, like, I've previously, like, I know you've been exposed to what happens in factory farms now. I've edited footage from, like, pig farms on a mass industrial scale. I don't think people necessarily get what the current situation is like in terms of cleanliness, hygiene, and all of that. And so perhaps that's an area where they can learn something by watching documentaries like yours.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, factory farming or just slaughterhouses are generally hidden from the public, so we don't see what's going on inside. And in Germany, we had lots of scandals where there was tainted meat. They had some kind of rotten meat that they sold. So all these scandals added up to more and more people ditching meat from their diets. So I think it's something that it's going to increase in the future.
And so I'm curious, obviously people should go and they should watch your documentary, but is there anything else that you would want someone who's perhaps curious about this, that's thinking about either reducing or cutting out meat, is there anything else that they should know about that they might have misconceptions about?
I think it's getting more and more easy to try out these products because they're everywhere to get, and there's more and more restaurants that have vegan or vegetarian products on their menus, so it's really easy to do that. And I think you should start slowly, maybe try out a few dishes, maybe go vegan for once a day per week and see how it works for you, and then work from there.
Okay. So where can people see The End of Meat?
It's out in the U.S. on Amazon Prime, iTunes, Microsoft Vudu, and Vimeo. And you can go to our website, theendofmeat.com, and you can click on Watch, and it'll show you all the links to the different platforms where you can see the film.
Okay, well, Mark Piechel, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to focus on education, AOC weighing in on some of the structural issues that might be being missed in our conversation about this college admissions scandal. And then The View on legacy admissions. That's going to be fun after this. So thanks to the fact that a number of different celebrities and really wealthy businessmen and all that decided to bribe their kids into the top flight universities, we're talking about education as a country and some of the inequalities that give us the results that we have in public education. That's a great thing. That's awesome. But the issue isn't just that some people who used to be on Full House are bribing their kids into Yale or USC or whatever. There are so many related issues that I really hope that we don't just cover this story, talk about the story for a week, and then we all move on. That would be like if we found out that, hey, black lung's coming back. Maybe our energy system is messed up. Let's just talk about black lung and then ignore it. In the same way that the Green New Deal understands that these are interconnected systems, that the inequalities are more foundational than just in any one issue, the same thing exists in education. So some people handing over $400,000 and getting fake soccer pictures or something, that's an issue. It needs to be dealt with. I don't know that people need to be dragged out of their homes with guns, but it's an issue. I understand that. But around it are some other big issues. And thankfully, I am seeing some conversation about that I hope is maintained. So Andy Zeiler on Twitter tweeted, perhaps this is a good time to talk about all the perfectly legal ways the wealthy are both allowed and expected to manipulate college admission systems while teaching their children to disparage affirmative action. That is totally true. I mean, people have talked about the fact that, like, Kushner's dad handed over 5 or 6 times as much money as any of these Full House or whatever celebrities did, and it was 100% legal. It was even more obviously a bribe, but we just expect that it's totally cool, not a big deal. If you name a dining hall after some venture capitalist, yeah, his kid gets to go to the college, obviously. Does that make any real sense? It's just one of those things that we accept and don't often question, but we should, and this is an opportunity. This is a window where we can possibly do that. Sort of related, AOC, who's obviously very focused on the influence of money in politics, having just run a very successful grassroots-funded campaign, said, I guess college admissions isn't that different from elections, where lots of money can buy your spot, too. Also, an environment where those who make it despite the odds are suspected to have not earned it, not truly belong, or assumed to not be able to perform at the same level. And of course, thankfully, in terms of education, I think people get that weird double standard exists where people who get in through legacy or through the huge amounts of resources that their family have, they're just expected that, yeah, this is part of an ongoing multi-generational dynasty at this university. Totally cool. Nothing to see here. But if you're poor, maybe you got in because of some demographic variable or something like that. Even though in many of these cases, obviously, they had a better call to actually be there, a better right to actually be there. And yeah, so that's something that needs to be dealt with. Now understand too that you have the bribing, you have the paying for the buildings and all that, the huge donations. But even for the people, the parents who don't go through that process, that doesn't mean that there's not massive financial inequality that's resulting in some kids going to college, particular colleges, high-priced colleges, and some not. And this is, I understand, an area where we're not talking about anything illegal being done. If you're raised in a way that you have the money, your family has the money to send you to, you know, a really expensive prep school or give you violin lessons or do SAT prep courses and things like that, that is totally legal. you have the access to it, of course you're going to take it. I don't begrudge anyone the ability to be seemingly a better fit with a college. But not everyone has that, obviously. Look, there are people whose families had a lot less resources than I did, but I didn't have anything like that. Part of the reason is my family never went to college. Between my two parents, there was one semester of college, and we didn't have any money to do any of those crazy extracurriculars or anything like that. I didn't even have great grades. Thankfully, I did okay on the SATs. No one has been able to explain how exactly that worked in practice, but thankfully that was enough to get me into a public university like UConn. But think about all the people who can't fall back on family, you know, legacy connections to universities, that their family's name isn't on a library or anything like that. And on top of it, they can't have these sorts of extremely expensive prep systems to get them into universities. And the thing is, honestly, it's worse now than it was even when I was trying to get into college. Because while standardized tests were certainly a thing, they seem to be a far bigger influence over who ends up in even state-level public universities than they were when I was trying to go to college. And we need to deal with that. Like, yes, if Lori Loughlin goes to jail, some people are going to say, hey, we dealt with the inequalities in our education system. But that is such a tiny portion of a far larger problem that we need to deal with. One more thing, we don't have time to get into it too in depth, but obviously the inequality isn't just before you get into college. We know that some people are going to leave college. It was paid off for them. They get to go off, get their job. They're not burdened by debt. They get to fully, you know, be a part of the economy. But many people don't, and they are burdened with literally a lifetime of debt. Now, how much would it cost to actually replace all of that? It's a lot of money. It's $1.5 trillion right now. And to give you an idea of how bad the problem is, it was a trillion like less than 5 years ago. So maybe this is something we should deal with before it gets even worse. But bear in mind, as AOC did, that's far less than we just gave away to the wealthiest individuals and corporations with the GOP tax bill of last year. In fact, that was $1.8 to $2.3 trillion, which would have comfortably paid for eliminating all student loan debt. And we would have had money left over for, I don't know, maybe we get healthcare or something. And the cool thing is about that is we give that money to the wealthy, we give it to the corporations or whatever, then they sit on it. They park it in an island chain you've never heard of. It doesn't actually do anything. It's not productive for the U.S. economy. But imagine, for all of the people that are currently burdened with student loan debt, I've seen some numbers that show that if we were to cancel it, which I get is a radical idea, 25 million American millennials, on average, would suddenly find that there's $30,000 less dollars in debt that they need to deal with. And here's the thing. Of all of the millennials that I have met in my life, very few have accounts in the Virgin Islands. And so if they suddenly had $30,000 effective dollars more of spending power, it would not end up in some bank account. It would end up going out into the economy. GOP loves to talk about how tax cuts stimulate the economy, despite the fact that there's very little evidence for that. But this sort of stimulus would have an immediate and enduring influence on the U.S. economy that we would reap the benefits for years, if not decades. It would be massive, not just for those 25 million American millennials, but for the economy at large. These are the sorts of larger conversations that we need to have, that we are lucky enough that conversation is being started thanks to some celebrities breaking the law to benefit their kids. And I care about that, but I care about the structural stuff far more. Okay, let's just really fast. Meghan McCain on The View, legacy admissions are in the conversation lately. She doesn't like that. Here's how she addressed the topic.
Legacy admissions, which means if your parents went to Brown or Harvard or you know, UP, you can go. But it's interesting because the idea of legacy admissions is racist in nature, and I'll tell you why. Mm. It started in the 20s to keep out upwardly mobile immigrants who had started pushing for admission to elite schools.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a very, very bad system legacy. Why should your kid get in because you got in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the only thing I will say
that's
is
not
when
fair.
It comes to
I didn't have any. I was the first person in my whole family to go to
academies,
college.
Military academies, my family goes back generations at the Naval Academy, mm-hmm. and that's service to your country. So I would push back in that part of it because my grandfather, great-grandfather, my brothers, they all served their
yeah,
country.
Yeah, but if you don't have the grades, why should you benefit from
that? They did have the grades. My brother did, but I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of the fact that my family's legacy is at the Naval Academy. My father's buried there.
I'm not talking about your family. I'm talking
about... You said
about,
legacy.
I'm talking about the policy of where legacy admissions came from.
I'm very proud of my family's legacy at the Naval
people
Academy.
And Jews, probably, out of the colleges.
Well, let me say...
That's what it's about.
Projection is an ugly thing. They're not talking about her. They're not talking about her family. But she is very defensive about nepotism. in terms of education, in terms of career. And I understand that. If I had a gigantic weakness, I'd probably be really aware of it. But thankfully, at least for the audience of The View, thanks to Joy Behar, they understand some of the historical context that led to the current legacy system. It doesn't get talked about, but there are gigantic racial and religious components to it as well. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the show today. We'll be back tomorrow with much more.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.